So let's talk about our objectives for this series. And this is the series in its entirety. These are not the objectives just for today or this current, I guess, topic that we're discussing. There's going to be a timeline that we go over in relation to the historical timeline that'll put some things into perspective. There may be some points in history that you're familiar with, and that will just sort of give you a starting point, so you go, okay, I know roughly about the time period that Islam, you know, gets its start, and these important things that occur in the Muslim Empire. Of course, our primary objective is to discuss Islam and its founding and its relation to Christianity. And then the last objective you can see up there, that's going to be a primary objective as well. The things that are in the middle are just ways for us to accomplish the start and the end of that. So I want to make sure that the focus here is how to reach Muslims for Christ by knowing more about their religion and what they believe, arguments that they use in opposition to Christianity, and different hurdles that we would have to knowledgeably get over before we could sort of begin the conversation with them to Christ. And that's going to be, you're going to understand that a lot more as I get into the background of this religion. It's not really complicated in the sense that, you know, we're going to be able to draw some comparisons, some other Abrahamic religions that have been founded, and I think that that'll help. But in another way, it is extremely complicated just because of the way that the Quran was written, and then you have Sharia law, you have different teachings that are outside of the Quran itself. And so understanding all of that is going to be instrumental in being able to reach these folks for Christ. We do want to analyze the teachings of Muhammad and the Quran. The religion of Islam cannot be separated from the Prophet Muhammad. So whereas, you know, there may be some sects of Christianity that maybe leave out portions of the Bible or, you know, add portions to the Bible, Islam is not really like that when it comes to the teachings of Muhammad and the Quran. We're going to talk about the Islamic Empire. There's some important battles that take place, of course, a series of battles that are known as the Crusades, where the Muslims are invading the Holy Land, and you have the changing of hands. Jerusalem is controlled by the church, the Roman Catholic Church, and then it's controlled again by the Muslims, and then this back and forth, a lot of atrocities committed by both sides. So that's actually a pretty interesting study. And then there's a couple different battles where the Muslim Empire actually tries to get into Europe, and of course they're stymied, which is why Europe is becoming Muslim now, but hasn't been Muslim in the past. And that's another conversation that we'll go over as well. And then just talk about modern Islam, which will be, of course, what we encounter, and then terrorism, because you can't really separate those two things either. They are not necessarily fundamental to Islam in the sense that, you know, majority of Muslims are interested in committing those atrocities. But the terrorist attacks themselves can't be separated from their religious motives. And anyone that tries to do otherwise is just trying to deceive you. It's rooted in the religion. And understanding that will help give us a much better perspective. So there's some terminology things that I want to go over. And just understand as I go over these terms, there are ways that we would prefer to define religious terms, and then there's ways that the historical and educational circles define these terms. Abrahamic religions, for example, we would not necessarily like to classify a lot of religions. We wouldn't like to associate a lot of different religions, majority of those false religions, with Abraham, because he is such an important and godly character in the Old Testament. However, when you're talking about religions that associate themselves with Abraham, that's where we have to make sure that we understand what those are. And these are the religions, the three Abrahamic religions that we need to discuss. So the first one's Christianity, and I have a sub point there, and we'll talk about Catholicism a little bit. Judaism is another Abrahamic religion, and then Islam is actually another Abrahamic religion. So some people may have a surface knowledge of that. Some people may actually be surprised to find that Islam considers itself, in fact, very closely related to those other two Abrahamic religions. Once again, we have to make sure that we can define Christianity from this perspective. True Christianity, hopefully everyone in here knows how to define. But in historical circles, when you talk about Christians, you're talking about Catholics. You're talking about Seventh-day Adventists. You're talking about Baptists. Okay? But you're also talking about Mormons. Okay? So the Christian world, if you were to Google, like I did, how many Christians, actually I didn't use Google, but if you were to search on the internet how many Christians are there in the world, you would go, wow, there's so many Christians. You know, the number is extremely skewed because the amount of religions that are even under that top point, that top subpoint, we would never classify as true religions. We would not even classify them as Protestant sects that we would say, you know, it's okay that we, you know, maybe associate with them sometimes, or you know, maybe I, Presbyterian, you know, came out with this commentary, and that's complete opposite. So when you see those numbers, don't think that, you know, this is our definition of Christianity, because it's not. It's an all-encompassing Christ-based religion. So very much like we have Abrahamic religions, religions that are based on Abraham sort of as a central figure, Christianity in our discussions typically means religions that are based on Jesus. And there's a lot of false religions that say that they're based on Jesus. So please understand that. Judaism is an Abrahamic religion. In fact, you could say it's sort of the original Abrahamic religion, since, you know, they were the chosen people of God all the way back during Abraham's time, and he's the one that received the promise of God. And then we've already mentioned that Islam is associated as well. I'm not going to get into the specifics as to why it's an Abrahamic religion yet, but we will get there. So let's talk about definitions here. Christianity refers to a monotheistic Abrahamic religion centered around the life, teachings, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. It is based on the belief in the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So there is, again, a lot of different religions that fit under that very general umbrella. Here are the basic core tenets of Christianity. Again, very, very broad. Belief in Jesus as the Son of God, belief in his teachings, miracles, death on the cross, and resurrection. The Bible is a sacred text, even though there are variations of the canon. Belief in the Trinity, sacraments, and of course how those are practiced vary greatly between the different Christian religions. And then aspects of worship. So how do you go about worshiping God, the Trinity, his Son, Jesus Christ? So that is when we talk about Christians associating themselves with Christ historically, that they're under all of those umbrellas. This is also, I don't think anybody would disagree with sort of the statement of faith that I just made. So going back to something that Pastor said, I think it was last week, when you are, you know, looking at a church or looking at a Christian organization and you look at their statement of faith and you go, wow, that's actually pretty good, does not really mean a whole lot. Because we would all agree with those core tenets of Christianity, and yet there's a lot of other false religions that would claim to agree with them, but are indeed false religions. Okay? So how do we define Judaism? Judaism is a monotheistic Abrahamic religion with a rich history, traditions, and ethical teachings. So that's a very, very brief definition. They do believe in monotheism, and this is important to differentiate. We would consider ourselves monotheistic because we do not believe the Trinity is three separate gods, as the Muslims believe that we do. But they do not believe, of course, in the Trinity, because the New Testament is what teaches us about that doctrine, with the Holy Spirit coming after the resurrection of Jesus, and of course Jesus himself being a part of the Godhead. The Tanakh is the Torah, the prophets, and the writings. Okay, so that's basically what just makes up the Jewish sacred texts. and really is, you know, if we're thinking about it, just the Old Testament on its own. Synagogue worship, of course, is important to Jews across the world. There are a lot of rabbinic traditions, and this is where we can't divert too far off this path, or else this will just become a class about Judaism, and we could have that as well. There's so many additional teachings from various rabbis throughout history that the Jews practice. So it's not just, you know, if you read the Old Testament, you say, okay, well, I know the Old Testament, so I have a grasp on exactly what the Jews believe and how they live, and that's rarely the case, because there's so many other traditions and teachings that come into play when one converts to Judaism, that the Old Testament really does not encompass their teachings entirely at all. So let's talk about Islam. How would we define that? It is also a monotheistic Abrahamic religion. It's founded on the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad and the revelations contained in the Quran, the Holy Scripture of Islam. Do not, again, ever differentiate or separate, would be a better word, the Prophet Muhammad and Islam. They are one and the same. To become a convert or to become a Muslim, the prayer or the saying that you recite in Arabic, you have to say that you believe in Allah, but also that Muhammad is his prophet. Okay? So you cannot say, well, I believe in Allah, but I don't really know too much about this Muhammad guy. If that's your stance, then you're not Muslim. And they will not accept you into the religion. The core beliefs of Islam require you to follow the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, which is a stark contrast with, of course, Christianity, right? Because we don't follow men. We don't require someone to believe in a fallible prophet, even if, you know, it's the Apostle Paul is a good example. Do you have to claim faith and trust in the writings of the Apostle Paul to become a Christian? No, right? I mean, it's part of the belief that the Bible is the Word of God, but we do not, you know, the sinner's prayer or the teachings that talk specifically about, I mean, 1 John is great in terms of just explaining how salvation works. Is anything in there additional to faith in Jesus Christ and a belief in his resurrection? And no. No, that's how you get saved. That's how you become a Christian in, again, our definition of that word. Tawhid is the monotheistic religion, part of their religion. It's spelled T-A-W-H-I-D. Of course, this is transliterated as best possible using Greek letters because Arabic has its own letter system. And I'm sure if someone in here spoke Arabic, they would be appalled at how poorly I pronounce their language. But I'm German, so give me a break. Prophethood, that's another, of course, part of it that we've already discussed. But they also believe that Muhammad is the final messenger of God, so there's no other revelation after the Quran and Muhammad's revelation. And it concludes the line of prophets that include Adam, Abraham, Moses, and Jesus. So, confused yet? It's kind of confusing, okay? But we're going to unravel all of this. So, the Quran. There are five pillars of Islam. Okay, so if you're taking notes, the five pillars of Islam. Shahada, which is the declaration of faith, has to be recited in Arabic. It is the affirmation of the oneness of God and the prophethood of Muhammad. That is all you have to do to become a Muslim. Okay? And they actually don't even... if you just recite the Shahada, then you are technically a Muslim. So it's really just the repetition of it. It's not so much the inwardness of it, is my understanding. And again, that could vary, you know, between different sects of Islam, but that's kind of an interesting point that that declaration, once you make it, you are considered kind of that fold. Now, they do believe that if you leave the religion of Islam, that you should be killed. So, the second pillar is Salah, S-A-L-A-H. That's prayer. So those are ritual prayers five times a day facing the Kaaba in Mecca. So you have to kind of orient yourself here. Mecca is east of us and probably a little bit south, so they would have to face this general direction when they pray five times a day. Just kind of an interesting example of that. When I was teaching, I was a long-term substitute at Bello Romero Academy, which is way East Greeley. You're almost in Kersey at that point. There's a very high percentage of Somalian Muslims. Somalia is a country in Africa. We're going to talk about why they're Muslim. But during class, we would have to excuse them for prayers because it was part of their religion. And actually, the kind of funny thing about it was that these kids didn't take it seriously at all. They were just like, well, you know, especially like during Ramadan, and they were, oh, we have to go pray. And then they'd just be out roaming the halls. You know, so they're just like any other kid that's like, well, I have an excuse to get out of class, so I'm just going to use it. And maybe they go pray, and probably they don't. But I just thought that that was an interesting exposure to the religion for me personally. The third pillar is zakat, which is charity. That's giving alms, charitable donations to support the less fortunate. You have saum, which is S-A-W-M, and that is the fasting during Ramadan. You have to fast from sunrise to sunset during the month of Ramadan. They use a lunar calendar. So on our calendar, it changes every year. It moves. So it gets a little bit earlier every year. And I believe it's during the month of July and August this year, I think. Don't quote me on that. The interesting thing about this fasting is that it's not just food fasting. They cannot drink anything, and that includes water. So from the time that the sun rises to the time that the sun sets, you are not ingesting anything. And if you can imagine that that month is going to take place in the summer in the United States or the summer in the Middle East, I'm sure there are plenty of people that go into all kinds of dehydration, shock, and have to be admitted to hospitals all over the world because of this practice. But it is one of the five pillars of the religion. And then the last pillar is the Hajj, which is H-A-J-J, two J's at the end, and that's the pilgrimage to Mecca. Undertaking the pilgrimage to Mecca at least once in a lifetime if you are financially and physically able. So this last pillar seems like maybe one of the most important if you were to be a Muslim, but there is a lot of leeway. As I was listening to a lecture by a man that knows a lot about this religion, he said something that was extremely interesting. He said, based on the number, and we're going to go over those numbers in a little bit, based on the number of Muslims worldwide, it would actually be impossible for all of the Muslims to make it to Mecca. So it's kind of odd that one of the pillars of the religion, we're actually getting to the point and have already gotten to that point, that threshold, where you can't even, you know, that would probably fall under the physically able. You can't physically go there anymore for a majority. So you would have to live, I mean, you can imagine that there's, because Mecca is in Saudi Arabia in the Middle East, that the folks that live in Saudi Arabia crowd that city so much that anyone that's outside that's trying to make a pilgrimage probably can't even get in at that point. So, you know, you can't even complete one of these core tenets. Yes?
Ramadan begins on March 10th this year.
Why was I thinking summer?
I don't know.
That must have been an old old information that I saw, and I didn't see a date on it. So it must have moved early enough in the calendar now that it's in spring. So that's hopefully a little bit better. And we don't have as many people that go suffer from dehydration. But I want to take some guesses here. And again, these are based on the general definitions that we gave. How do you think the numerical breakdown is for these? And I'll say four. So we'll include Catholicism within the numbers of Christianity, but I'll let you guys guess that separately. So first, how many Christians do you think there are in the world? Now, before you guess, just understand the population, the total world population, the most current number is 7.9 billion. So we'll just round up to 8 billion people. What percentage, or no, let's just give a total number. What total number do you think out of those 8 billion claim to be associated with a Christian religion? Yes.
I guess 2 billion.
Okay. Any other guessers? Yes.
I would go with
4 billion. 4 billion. Okay. And so now let's talk Catholicism. Again, that's going to have to be contained within the number that you think might be associated with Christianity. How many do you think are associated with the Roman Catholic Church? And you've got to think of this in a worldwide mental space, because if you just think about the United States, you'll way undershoot it. Think about the percentage of people in Spain alone that are Catholic. We're talking about a vast majority of Spaniards, vast majority of Italians, even France. A lot of Catholics in France. So, guesses? Yes.
3 billion,
okay. It's tough, isn't it? It's tough to see without like the total number of Christians. You might be able to get closer if you knew how many that was. How many Jews do you think there are in the world?
I'd say less than a billion, maybe
500
million.
You're right. It is definitely less than a billion.
Less than a billion,
with a B, yes. Okay, 500 million. Any other guesses? You don't have to raise your hand. You can just shout it out since we're going through this quickly. No? Okay, Islam. How many Muslims are there in the world? Over half of the total population? That would be terrifying. Luckily, no. So here are the numbers. So Christianity... 2.3. These are rough estimate. This is AI information. This is Chat GPT. Okay, so probably, I mean, it's that artificial intelligence platform has the most up to date information. But it even said, you know, this is going to be extremely rough estimates, because how in the world do you run a census of everyone that associates? Because there's probably a lot of people in the Middle East that wouldn't associate themselves with Christianity, even if they were Christians, because they'd be killed. So you can't even get accurate numbers. But 2.3 billion, roughly, Christians, and a little over half of that are Catholics. So if you're wondering how wealthy the Catholic Church is, 1.3 billion people. There's a lot of Catholics that don't give to the Catholic Church, but there's a lot that do. Okay. And if they all gave a dollar, that's still $1.3 billion. Judaism is only 14 to 15 million, which surprised me. I thought it was going to be maybe a little bit closer to where Mr. Pierce guessed, that maybe at least like 100 million, but pretty small number if you compare it to the rest of the numbers up there. And then Islam is 1.3 billion. So Christianity, Christian religions, they do outpace still Islam, although those numbers are kind of moving. Now, we really need to try to separate these numbers and figure out, okay, so how many born-again Christians are there in the world? Because that would give us maybe a little bit better feeling for our community, sort of the global church. How many are there? And these are not my numbers. Again, this is from the same source as all these numbers came from. So we're going to exclude Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses. These are not born again. And again, we don't like this term, but if you're going to classify it, evangelical Christians, You're trying to find out, okay, like church-going, average American idea of Christianity, how many of those people are there? 600 to 700 million. And we can speculate that many of those are unsaved and are only identifying with the various sects that are within this sect. Okay, so if we're talking about born-again Christians, this includes Baptists, Pentecostals, non-denominational, which could be all sorts of types of people, Lutheran, Methodist, Reformed, Presbyterian. These are all classified under the 600 to 700 million. And are we saying that all of the people in those churches are saved? No. We can say beyond a shadow of a doubt, because we would, there probably, and Pastor says this often, there's probably a lot less people saved within churches like ours than we think, right? So, you know, that's just a result of the Reformation. After Martin Luther's Reformation, there were just all kinds of divisions of Protestantism that fractured off. And of course, the Lutheran religion there, which is not really that associated with Martin Luther's teaching, you can see that there as well. All right, let's talk about some timeline information here so we can get an idea of when Islam is coming into the world. The older the history is, the less certain we are about things, because history can only be determined by the availability of primary sources. And I've explained what primary and secondary sources are before, but just as a review, a primary source is something that comes from the period of history that we're talking about. Okay? A secondary source is something that's written about that, and it could have been written in the 1960s, the 1870s, it could have been written yesterday. All of that is considered a secondary source. It's even a secondary source if it was written 100 years or 50 years after it happened by someone who is not a contemporary of that exact event. Okay? So just bear that in mind. If, you know, if it's not from the time period, if it's not an archaeological artifact, if it's not something that's written by someone who lived through it, then we can't know for sure, and a lot of it is just compiling secondary sources and making a best guess. That's why the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus is approximately 33 AD. Okay. Could be a little bit later. Probably not a little bit earlier, but the death of the Apostle John, we can sort of, we know roughly a time period when the book of Revelation was written, and you said 95? About 95. So, you know, if he wrote it in 91 and then passed away in 92, again, you know, we just have this decade of time that we're just kind of looking at. So this would be the, if I'm not mistaken, Pastor, this would be the last apostle. As far as you know. So as far as we know, this is the death of the last living primary source person who personally, you know, interacted with Jesus and was a direct target of his teaching. Now, there could have been other people that were disciples during the time that would have been very young, you know, when Jesus was crucified. You know, maybe they were 10 or 12. Could be that they outlived, at that point, the Apostle John. There's a very good chance of it. And so they would be disciples and would therefore be considered primary sources. But imagine trying to preserve something for 2,000 years. So they could have written their own diary. They could have written, you know, a book about their own experiences. And it was just lost to history, just the amount of time that empires change hands and cities are sacked, and there you go. First Council of Nicaea. Does anyone know what the Council of Nicaea was? Pastor does, but that's not fair. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so it was really the first council of Christian religions, and they sent various leaders to this area, which is located in modern-day Turkey, and they talked about just basically figuring out what are the basic tenets of the Christian religion. So, like, what are the doctrines that are required to be a Christian? And, of course, it's so long ago that you know, those definitions have changed for us, but that's what they were trying to figure out. And this is during the time of Constantine. Yep. So Constantine was emperor. He was really emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire, which was based in Constantinople. This is the Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire, Western Roman Empire. He divided the empire, and he governed mostly that eastern portion. Constantine claimed to be a Christian himself, and of course, then we have Orthodox Christianity that grows up from the Byzantine Empire, and that's why a lot of Christians that are under that umbrella in Eastern Europe are Orthodox Christians. So if you think about, I don't know, you may not be able to kind of picture this, but like the Onion Dome with the cross on top, usually it's like you might see a Greek church that looks like Greek Orthodox. Orthodox Christianity sort of grows up out of this area. But it's not until 380 that the Edict of Thessalonica makes Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. And it's less than 100 years after that the Roman Empire officially falls. Rome is sacked a couple times before that, but then in earnest, I mean, the government is deposed and the Western Roman Empire falls. And then what you're left with is that Eastern Roman Empire, which is the Byzantine Empire that's based out of Constantinople, which is today Istanbul, Turkey. Continuing the timeline, so we're going from 476 to 610. This is when Muhammad claims to receive his first vision from the angel Gabriel. In 622, Muhammad and his followers are fleeing heavy persecution in Mecca, and they flee to Medina in a pilgrimage that's known as the Hijra. Muhammad's religion in Mecca was not very popular because the teachers or the religion in Mecca was basically the focal point. It was a big business and trade city, and a lot of people would go to Mecca to worship. And this new religion that he was trying to get started, this is what is kind of, he's teaching it as the one true religion. So if you're a person that makes a lot of money off of another religion, and now you've got this guy that's trying to basically say that it's false, then you're going to lose money on all the people that go to your city that are practicing a pilgrimage. Yes.
What had been the religion? Was there one certain one?
And I don't know the name of it. It was pretty pagan. Yeah, it was a pagan religion. Just kind of a historical Middle Eastern. I believe it was very polytheistic as well.
Zoroastrianism.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, something polytheistic and apparently very heavily practiced because Mecca is making so much money off of, you know, these people coming and worshiping at this. Well, we use Mecca actually as its own, as a noun, as just a general noun. So it's the Mecca of whatever, but this is the actual Mecca of Mecca. Yeah. I'm a Nebraska fan, so the Mecca of college football is Memorial Stadium in Lincoln. But it's kind of funny how we use that term. This is literal Mecca. Battles of Badr and Uhud. These are battles that are fought by Muhammad and his followers. They become violent really pretty quickly, 14, 15 years after the first vision from Gabriel. His religion's already fighting. And the people that they're fighting are the Meccans. And so we have this conflict. These are the major battles in that conflict. Muhammad and his followers win those battles, and they return to Mecca in a bloodless coup. They are accepted. They then control Mecca, and then 2 years later, Muhammad passes away. And this is where we get the Shia and Sunni division. Those are the two main divisions of Islam. The Sunnis make up way more of the Muslims than the Shias do. We'll talk about the differences in belief, but it basically just has to do with the line of the caliphate. So who is going to, you can kind of think of the caliphate as, and Muslims don't, I actually made this comparison to a student of mine who was a Muslim and he didn't like the comparison, but it is essentially what it is. Just think of the caliph as the Pope of Islam. Now, they have not had a caliphate since the Muslim Empire because they can't unify enough to set one up. And many people believe, I mean, if you think about 1.3 billion Muslims, if they were actually able to agree on a caliphate and unify, that probably would not be very good for the world because it's that division that's sort of keeping its growth and most likely the spread of jihad at bay. The Shias are the ones who are actively involved in this jihad. So when you talk about Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, the different terrorist organizations, they are usually of the Shia sect of Islam. Okay? The Sunnis, it's very, very uncommon for a Sunni Muslim to be involved in a terrorist attack. Okay, so with that, I'll take just general questions